081535, Ahmed Hassan v. Eric Holder, Jr.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, my name is David Cook, and I am counsel for the petitioner, Mr. Ahmed Hassan. There are two issues that are raised within this petition for review. The original and threshold issue concerns the negative credibility determination of the immigration judge, as affirmed by the Board of Immigration Appeals, and whether or not that determination finds substantial evidentiary support within the record. Part and parcel of that question is whether or not that determination is supported by a recent codification of a credibility standard that's contained within the May 11, 2005 statutory amendment to the Immigration and Nationality Act by way of the Real ID Act of 2005. The second issue is, should the petitioner prevail on credibility, and should this court overturn the negative credibility determination, what is presented before the court is a legal question as to whether or not the harm suffered by Mr. Hassan, which includes a November 2004 incident in which he was shot at and which he was pursued by Ethiopian soldiers, resulting in the killing death of his cousin, Mr. Anwar Gamada, whether or not that event is tied to or finds a nexus with his innate characteristic as a son of a former OLF leader, or one who exhibits strong family ties to the OLF, or a political opinion that had been imputed upon him by his assailants.
How fluent is Mr. Hassan in the Amharic language?
Your Honor, he does understand the Amharic language. He does understand English as well. His English is quite good. He was assisted by myself, the trial-level attorney, as well as another Ethiopian detainee at the McHenry County Jail Detention Facility. I would note, Your Honor, that this is a case that proceeded on the detained docket of the Chicago Immigration Court, which is an expedited docket. And thus, we believe that the application is complete and that the immigration judge's complaint that the application was not complete was wholly unreasonable, especially given in light of the fact that the petitioner was detained throughout proceedings before the immigration judge and before the Board of Immigration Appeals. As such, as you can understand, it's very difficult for a detainee within that position to obtain not only counsel, accessing counsel, but also accessing a foreign language translator, especially an individual in this circumstance where his native language is the Oromo language.
Did he ever object to the use of video conferencing for his hearing? Did he?
No, Your Honor, we did not object to at the IJ level to the use of video conferencing. We felt that in the totality of the circumstances that video conferencing did prejudice, where we brought forth within the petitioner's opening brief and before the Board of Immigration Appeals a claim of prejudice to a statutory right to a full and fair hearing. I believe that the video conferencing errors would not, I believe that this court had held that video conferencing in and of itself does not constitute a constitutional violation or a statutory violation to that right. Our position is that the video conferencing was one of the factors that caused the immigration judge to express frustration with the petitioner. It was the video conferencing that had frustrated or had rather obscured the colloquy between the immigration judge and the petitioner, and I believe the immigration judge had taken that to constitute a sign of his evasiveness.
Tell me this. Is there any evidence that members of the Ethiopian government looked for Hassan's family after they left Ethiopia in 1986 or have been looking for them more recently?
With respect to this court's latter question, Mr. Hassan is unable to locate his family, his sister, his mother. He has no knowledge of their whereabouts at this present time. I don't believe there is evidence within the record that would establish whether or not there was a search for the family once they had fled to Djibouti in 1986.
Could his claim succeed without any of the four incidents omitted from his written asylum application?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe so. I think that question turns on whether or not the 2004 shooting incident would constitute a past persecution. That question has not been squarely answered by the immigration judge or the Board of Immigration Appeals. I believe the BIA, within its original order in direct appellate proceedings, notes that everything other than the November 2004 shooting incident would not constitute a persecution. I think what one can take away from that is that it is stipulated by the agency that the November 2004 incident in which he was shot at, in which he was pursued, constitutes a direct harm to him that would rise to the level of a past persecution in which he is entitled to a rebuttable presumption of a future persecution. If there are no further questions, I will continue with my prepared remarks. We believe that it was unreasonable for the immigration judge to complain that the asylum application was incomplete. The second question that is before the court is a legal issue, and the alternate finding of the immigration judge is, assuming arguendo, that the petitioner's testimony was credible. Nonetheless, the agency determined that his application for asylum would fail and that the harm suffered was not tied to a statutorily enumerated basis within the statutory refugee definition. In the case at bar, the petitioner puts forth his application for asylum that's based upon his particular social group membership and a political opinion that had been imputed upon him by his assailants on the basis of his family ties to the Oromo Liberation Front. The IJ cast the petitioner's representation that the Ethiopian government knew of his presence in the country due to a government informant in the neighborhood as pure speculation. That determination finds absolutely no support within the record. In particular, I would point to AR 514, the Human Rights Watch report, which establishes that the EPRDF, the ruling coalition government of Ethiopia since 1991, maintains a near police state vigilance or surveillance of the Oromia region or the Oromo-populated areas of Ethiopia. Thus, we believe that the record demonstrates that it's objectively reasonable and not speculative that a neighborhood informant had warned the Ethiopian authorities of Mr. Hassan's presence. I would also point to this court's decision in KB versus the Attorney General. In that decision, in the KB decision, this court discusses the fear of harm an individual who is an OLF member or suspected of OLF membership may have against the Ethiopian government. The government advances a theory of the case that Mr. Hassan was shot at merely because he fled the burial ceremony upon their arrival. This, of course, assumes that the Ethiopian soldiers possess no advanced knowledge of what was going on with respect to the burial ceremony of the petitioner's aunt who had passed away, who herself was the spouse of an OLF dissident. The government assumes that the shots were fired and the petitioner was pursued solely and simply because he ran upon their arrival at the gravesite's entrance and because he failed to stop when he was commanded to do so. Again, we feel that this contention finds no support within the record. Secondly, it's our position that that contention this court does not have jurisdiction to consider that contention inasmuch as it falls within the Chenery Doctrine. It's not located within the four corners of the decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals, in either decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals, or that of the original underlying decision of the immigration judge.
You're in your rebuttal.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Robbins, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Robbins. I'm here on behalf of Eric Holder, the respondent. Your Honors, the petitioner's initial claim for persecution in Ethiopia in his initial asylum application and the statement which accompanied that asylum application is, to be reasonable, a bit thin. He's basing persecution on account of a family member from back in 1986, and there was an 18-year absence in Ethiopia where he claims that he fled to Djibouti with his mother. Now, the sole incident in which he's claiming that he himself was persecuted was in 2004 when he came back for a day or two with his cousin and attended his cousin's mother's funeral. And he's speculating that the Ethiopian soldiers who drove up to this funeral somehow knew that from 18 years earlier that his father was involved with the OLF and somehow attributed this political opinion to him. Now, what happens to thin claims during examination and cross-examination is oftentimes when a case is revealed to be thin, you get evolving accounts. And that's what these omissions from his asylum application, which ended up coming up during testimony, and that's why these omissions matter. Now, these are not just minor details that came up during testimony that were omitted from the asylum application. These are major events. He claims that his house was burned down. He claims that his entire family was threatened. He claims that the Djibouti police were looking to repatriate him to Ethiopia. These are claims that weren't in his asylum application that are specifically requested in the asylum application. He specifically testified to the immigration judge that his application was complete. When you look at the application, you can see that it's clearly been edited and corrected and that some thought has been put into this. So, again, the petitioner is saying now that, well, I was just complimenting my asylum application with these additional facts. But these are major facts, and they're indicative of an evolving account. Now, has he offered plausible explanations for these things? Yes, he has offered plausible explanations. But under this court's standard of review, the question is not whether he has a plausible explanation for the changes. The question is whether or not the record compels one explanation over the other. Now, given the fact that he had testified that his story was complete first, and then as the story became to be exposed as thin during testimony, you know, is the only way the immigration judge could have come out that he was credible? I don't think you can reasonably argue that.
But how can the IJ's credibility determination withstand scrutiny when the BIA has acknowledged that the IJ erroneously believed that Hassan was lying about the fact that his asylum application was translated to him in Amharic and not his native Oromo?
Well, it's true that there was error in determining that the native language was Oromo, but again, this is harmless error because the petitioner has just conceded during oral argument that his client understands the language in which it was translated, which is Amharic.
Well, you can understand and you can understand. I understand a little French. I would hate to, be questioned in French. How can we be certain that the IJ's belief that Hassan was creating a false excuse for the omissions in his application didn't color his entire analysis of Hassan's credibility?
Well, I mean, it's impossible to become certain of anybody's state of mind, but when you look at the different rationales for why the immigration judge specifically made the adverse credibility finding, it's not limited to whether or not he understood the language. It's partly that the asylum application was specifically edited, and you can see in the record that thought was put into it. This is not a pro se alien who was just filling out a cursory asylum application. He was represented by counsel during this time.
See, I cannot get through my head why the omitted facts are central to Mr. Hassan's claim, and it certainly would be draconian to enter an adverse credibility finding based solely on facts omitted from the written application.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the Real ID Act specifically says that these kind of inconsistencies do not have to be central. They do not have to go to the heart of an applicant's claim. That's what the Real ID Act specifically contemplates.
Right, but it doesn't direct the IG to construe or the IJ to construe omissions from the written application against the petitioner, and his story doesn't contain any inconsistencies that call the truthfulness of his account into question. He's omitted from his written application four relatively peripheral facts. I'm just so troubled deferring to the credibility finding in light of the IJ's other errors, his erroneous belief that Hassan made up a false excuse for failing to include the information his misperception of Hassan as unresponsive, a perception that the BIA itself acknowledges on remand was caused by the teleconferencing equipment. And
well, respectfully, Your Honor, with respect to the video conferencing incident, at the very beginning of the merits hearing, there was this video conferencing error where the immigration judge couldn't hear what the petitioner was saying. But that's the only incident. They went off record, and then they came back on record, and there was no indication in the record after that point of any problems with the video conferencing. The petitioner has jumped on this particular video conferencing as though it tainted the entire testimony. But it didn't taint the testimony with respect to the omissions of his asylum application. It's only in the beginning that we have this problem with the video conferencing, and that's the only incident, and it was corrected. As far as the immigration judges, as far as whether or not these omissions from the asylum application directly conflict. I mean, you're never going to have a situation where you omit something from an asylum application and then you bring up new factual assertions during testimony. They're never going to directly conflict because you're bringing up new things that haven't been asserted for the first time. That's always going to be the other side of the coin. But again, under this court's standard of reviewing whether or not the immigration judge was reasonable in this, you can definitely go both sides to the coin every time. But the question is whether or not the record is compelled to go to accept these explanations. And given the fact that he had been represented by counsel, and you know, when it comes up in these four specific facts, even though they don't directly conflict with his testimony, you can certainly see why these new factual assertions may have been asserted. I mean, when he mentions that one of these incidents is regarding the Djibouti police, you know, when you present your claim originally as, you know, and it's thin, but you realize that it's thin because you spent 18 years outside of the country in which you're claiming that you were persecuted and only came back for one day, that's when it's necessary to make that new factual assertion that the Djibouti police are looking for.
For one day and you're being shot at.
Well, how
does that factor in?
Assuming this is credible, there's no question that being shot at is a terrible event. In Ethiopia, I'm not making the argument that it's the same thing as the United States. But you, in order to convince an immigration judge that you're meeting your burden of proof for establishing eligibility for asylum, withholding of removal, and CAT, you can't just speculate as to the motives that maybe they were persecuting me on account of my political opinion. And that's ultimately what he did with his claim. He speculates. He says, well, maybe some neighborhood informants told them that I had returned after
death. Well, what more could he do? You're speculating that, you know, some soldiers just came to some random funeral and started shooting. That's pretty bizarre.
Respectfully, that's not what we're asserting. If you look at the record, he claims that he fled, and then they commanded him to stop, and then they shot. The other people at the funeral who did not flee, he admits, were not harmed in any way. So it was only him and his cousin who had specifically fled these military soldiers.
Because it's only him and his cousin who belong to families who are part of this group. The rest of them are just, you know, the neighbors and the villagers and the housewives.
Well, respectfully, there is no presumption of credibility in these cases. You have a specific burden. Admittedly, it can be hard sometimes to make these specific assertions, but speculation isn't sufficient.
Given the immigration judge's discussion of the Real ID Act in his original opinion, why did the government request a remand for a credibility determination under the Real ID Act? Do you know?
Well, after looking at it, when I looked at the immigration judge's decision, he definitely does mention the Real ID Act, but it appears that he applies the old standard, and I'm not sure whether or not that was because he felt that these did regard that these even if these had gone to the heart of the petitioner's claim, it didn't matter. But I know that the government wanted to be careful and give the agency a chance to specifically address Real ID if in fact it had been improper. Are there any other particular questions about this case? Thank you very much for your time, Your Honors, and we would respectfully request that this court uphold the decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins.
Thank you very much for your time, Your Honors.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Cook, what do we make of the fact that he did not seek asylum in any of the think, five or six countries that he was in.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand.
Right.
The immigration judge. Well, the immigration judge had held that traveling through intermediary third countries, the four or five countries that he had traveled through, had constituted substantial evidence that he was not credible, that this was an individual who did not possess that did not fall within the refugee statute, that he was a person who was not seeking, was not fleeing persecution, but that he was coming to the United States as an economic migrant. The fact that he did not apply, the statute holds that an individual will be divested of the right to apply for asylum should that individual be firmly resettled within a third country. And what that requires is a legal residence or the equivalent of an offer of legal residence within that country. That's never occurred within any of the countries in which the petitioner had had passed through Djibouti.
He was
Yemen.
In Djibouti 18 years, though. That's
correct. That is correct. But he had, as reflected within the record, he had lived in that country without a legal residence. He did not attend public school within that country. He was not able to meaningfully engage with other children. He was not able to go to hospital when he was injured.
And when he arrives here, he's has a phony Swedish passport. And I think if you arrive in some countries with a phony passport, they send you right back, don't they?
No, an individual...
He got to stay here.
Well, an individual who expresses a fear of harm of being returned to their home country, they are exempt from the expedited removal process, which is a deportation in the first instance by the port of entry officer. The statute precludes those individuals. Those individuals are given a right to advance their application before an immigration judge in statutory removal proceedings.
Could he have filed for some sort of relief when he arrived in, say, Germany?
With respect to Germany, I believe that was in transit.
He was there 2 months.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. He had, as reflected within the record, he had testified that he had obeyed the strict orders of his alien smuggler, Mr. Mustafa, and he was instructed to. He had followed the instructions of Mr. Mustafa, and thus I believe that the original plan was to apply for asylum upon arrival in the United States, in particular in California.
Some of those countries he passed through were signatories to the Convention Against Torture, aren't they?
I'm sorry?
Some of the countries he passed through are signatories to the Convention Against Torture, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd even note that Djibouti is a signatory nation to the Convention Against Torture, and the record reflects that Djibouti forcibly repatriates ethnic Oromos to Ethiopia without the due process of law. I think the fact that that some of these countries are signatory nations to the Convention Against Torture, I think, with all due respect, I don't think that's a dispositive to this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of our counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.